KXSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Conspiracy culture, it's a distraction machine. Conspiracy influencers may get the facts wrong, but they often get the feelings right. But the thing about getting the facts wrong and the feelings right, those elites are sucking people dry. Their labor, their time, their security, their data. The Davos elite aren't eating our children, as some seriously claim that they are, but they are eating our children's future, and that is plenty bad.
That's Naomi Klein, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Naomi Klein on conspiracy culture. Conspiracy, conspiracy culture, conspiracy theories. Just saying those words can make some people cringe and others to embrace them. Conspiracy theories are as old as the hills, but today, thanks to social media algorithms that push users toward ever-emotional, fact-adverse content, it's never been easier for wild, implausible ideas and hate to go viral. It's a rabbit hole that detracts attention from predatory economic policies that have created a gargantuan gap in wealth and power. Instead of focusing on what elites are actually doing, people are diverted into cultural wars about all-gender bathrooms, anti-racist education, non-white immigrants, LGBTQ athletes, which are all part of a deep state cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophiles who control the world. Conspiracy culture makes the ruling class secure in knowing societal anger isn't aimed at them. Our guest today is Naomi Klein. She's a leading Canadian author, social activist, and filmmaker. She's a professor in the Department of Geography at the University of British Columbia and the founding co-director of UBC's Center for Climate Justice. She's a columnist for The Guardian. She's the award-winning author of such books as No Logo and The Shock Doctrine. Her latest book is Doppelganger. She spoke at Socialism 2023 in Chicago on September 3rd. And now, Naomi Klein.
You've created a space for us to share our experiences, our truths with one another, to inspire each other, and most of all, most critically, to strategize with one another. So being here is wonderful. It's also a little uncanny. Uncanny in the sense that it feels very familiar, but also a little bit altered, strange, different. The last time I was at Socialism, just over 4 years ago, and the title of our plenary then was Care and Repair, the Revolutionary Democratic Power of a Global Green New Deal. Now, I still believe in that, still work on that, research it, do that work, but it's a pretty different topic than what I'm talking about tonight, which is the pulsing world of fantastical far-right conspiracies, its relationship to liberal abandonments, and how the left can and must respond. And this change feels significant to me. It feels significant because it points to the fact that we are not the same people that we were 4 years ago. None of us. The world has changed, and those changes have changed us. And our opponents have changed too, which is what I'll be discussing today, in ways I believe we must seek to understand. The only lasting truth is change, Octavia Butler wrote. Nostalgia, trying to recapture a wave that has long since crashed, is a fool's errand. In 2020, our dear friend Arundhati Roy told us something I think we all remember, that the pandemic was a portal, that it was so cataclysmic that it would necessarily take us somewhere new. She pointed out that the somewhere could be better based on that ethos of care and repair that we gathered to discuss those years before. And I'm willing to bet that virtually every single one of you worked your butts off to try to bring about that more beautiful and just future in the years since we have seen each other. Many of you began the pandemic working full throttle for Bernie. Is that right? A few of you? And then many of you pivoted to fighting for permanent debt cancellation, permanent eviction bans, the right to housing, police defunding. Some of you gave your all to pushing the Biden administration to take climate action inspired by the Green New Deal. I think it's fair to assume that most everybody here marched your feet off raw in the uprising for Black Lives in the summer of 2020. I'll bet many of you marched again in the global Palestine solidarity demonstrations in the spring of 2021, inspired by the Sheikh Jarrah resistance to forced expulsion and the subsequent attack on Gaza, one of so many. Now, if you, like me, are here from Canada, a few Canadians here, I'm willing to bet that you were part of the outpouring of solidarity and also grieving, supporting Indigenous communities who confirmed the presence of unmarked children's graves on the sites of former so-called residential schools, graves that the communities always knew were there. Of course, all of this movement labor continues, but I think it is worth pausing to recall that these were moments when a great many of us felt in our hearts and in our spirits that something big was about to change. I know I felt that way on the Bernie campaign in the summer of 2020, and even in the early months of the pandemic when so many people were reexamining how they lived, right? And when the pandemic acted as an unveiling for so many of the shadow lands that support the people who were fortunate enough to be locked down. Did it change? Angela Davis put the tension of the moment like this. In many ways, nothing has changed at all, but at the same time, everything has changed. In these effervescent moments, right, when suddenly we find ourselves surrounded by millions of people, right, we saw how much latent support exists for transformational visions of a radically different world. A world based on those principles of caring for one another and the earth and making reparations for the centuries of damage done to both. We found new comrades. We shifted the discourse, as they say, and not just the discourse. Workplaces got organized, contracts got ratified, police got kicked out of schools. I could go on and list many of these unsung victories. But I think it's also true that many of us would agree that this is not a moment for cheerleading or self-congratulation for the left. Because we are through the pandemic's portal, even though the virus is still with us, and I don't think that we much like the scenery. The new landscape is objectively more perilous, more monstrous than the one left behind, which I don't need to tell you was no picnic to begin with. And if we are to fight for a better world in this new place, then I think we need to understand its terrain a little bit better, its contours a little better. I think we need to map it. So I'm going to try to do that a little bit, some of the things that are front of mind. Obviously, millions of people have died from COVID globally, more than a million right here in the U.S., and policymakers and politicians tell us that we should all get comfortable with more culling of the most vulnerable. We now have saws embedded in buoys on the border with Mexico, skies choked with rancid smoke in city after city, incinerated cities and towns, most recently in Lahaina, poison drugs cutting down lives mid-breath in their thousands. We see police budgets heavier with new instruments of death. Supremacists at the helm in India, in Italy, in Israel, banging at the gates in the U.S. Waves after waves of evictions, wave after wave of extinctions. Some call this necropolitics, others social murder. Whatever you call it, we are in the teeth of a machinery that shrugs at, chooses not to prevent or actively encourages mass death, a politics that spreads deadening through the culture, that runs the risk of making the living feel dead, flat, unmoved, unresponsive to attacks. Now, some of you might be asking yourselves about now, what is she doing? Why is she listing off so many terrible things? And the answer is, well, I have also changed. And the changed me is committed to trying to create and hold space for left sadness, for our disappointments, for our heartbreaks, for comrades we lost too soon. The great Egyptian revolutionary and political theorist, Ali Abed El Fattah, who is still languishing behind bars after 12 years in Egypt, says, "You have not yet been defeated." True. But we are injured. We are hurt, some impaired, some, like Ali, far more hurt than others. And this is true not only of us as individuals, but I would argue also of our movements. The dreams that we once dreamed so boldly in public are a little bit damaged. And the injured state goes beyond the individual, beyond the social movements. As the great disability justice theorist Sonara Taylor reminds us, the planet, our shared home, is also injured. Like so many humans and other than human life forms, the lands are scarred, charred, thirsty, poisoned, slipping, sliding, falling. One thing I know to be true is that grief and trauma denied and unexpressed do not disappear. They will instead find new ways to express themselves. Only the ways will be twisted and warped and directed at the wrong targets. We cannot afford that, not in our individual bodies and not in our movement bodies. Now, many of you will have heard the famous quote by Samuel Beckett, "Ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better." We use it on the left to console one another about our political disappointments. But how will we fail better if we do not make time to examine why we failed last time? Without rancor, as free as possible from interpersonal denunciation, with compassion, with love, but with as much honesty as we can bear. And I'm not arguing that we should stop everything and just do this inner work, because the attacks never stop, and that is not an option. But I do think that we must make time and collective space. I'm not talking here about personal therapy, although that's fine. I'm talking about collective space to actually feel our griefs and losses and those disappointments, because that is how we heal, that is how we recover, that is how we get stronger. And stronger we must be, because we, all of us, are needed. The radical left is needed. It is needed in fighting form. It is needed to combat the far right and the web of fantastical conspiracies that have taken over the political discourse with startling speed. Now, before I go deeper into those conspiratorial worlds, I want to acknowledge that as a leftist, this is complicated for me. And I think some of you understand why. When radical and anti-establishment writers and scholars attempt to analyze the underlying systems that built and uphold power in our world, including the proven existence of covert operations to eliminate threats to those systems, it is common to get dismissed as conspiracy theorists. It's happened to everyone, it's happened to me. In truth, it is one of the most battle-worn tactics used to bury and marginalize ideas that are inconvenient to those who wield economic and political power, or who feel personally attacked by anti-corporate, anti-capitalist or anti-racist analyses because the critiques implicate them. You know, we saw this very prominently with the way the media responded to Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's manufacturing consent, right? It's a conspiracy theory. Every serious left-wing analyst of power has faced this smear. So let's draw a sharp distinction between, one, honest efforts to expose the real conspiracies that have always been part of capitalism, from price fixing and corporate cover-ups to the CIA's long history of covert ops and dirty tricks, mostly against revolutionaries at home and abroad, and two, dishonest conspiracy fabulists and online influencers spreading sensationalist, unproven, and often contradictory theories for clout and cash and political power. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about far-right conspiracy theories. Think Jewish space lasers and the like. So in my new book, I call the dynamic the doppelganger effect. I started thinking about doppelgangers a lot in the first year of the pandemic because, well, it was 2020, and I was stuck at home, and so I was online way too much because where else was I going to be? When I went online, I had this very strange experience because I would invariably be greeted in those early pandemic months by people screaming at me or thanking me or expressing their pity for me about things I had said and done, only it wasn't me. It was her, my doppelganger, which is to say a person who I have been perennially confused and conflated with for many years now. Another author who writes books critical of elite power, named Naomi Wolf. She'll be familiar to Gen Xers in the room. Now, the reason why I got interested in my particular doppelganger is because during the pandemic, she started acting very strangely, kind of like a doppelganger of herself, of her former self. And so very many people, other than her, also started acting strangely in this period. And I'm sure you may be making a list in your mind of people who seem to have done that during the pandemic, right? Spreading all kinds of medical misinformation about the virus, about masking, about lockdowns, about vaccine verification apps. She was not so much a conspiracy theorist as a conspiracy influencer, right? It's really conspiracy without a theory because the theories are constantly contradicting each other, right? Like COVID is a bioweapon. No, it's a cold. Don't worry about it. Don't wear a mask, right? It's the vaccine that's tracking you. No, it's the app that's tracking you, right? Like it's all the Chinese Communist Party social credit system that's coming to the West. That was a big one. So that was something that my doppelganger said a lot. And not surprisingly, there was a big audience for this on the right, particularly on Fox News, coming from a former, you know, famous feminist, former advisor to Al Gore, very connected to the Democratic Party. If you're willing to say that a vaccine verification app is actually bringing tyranny to the United States, well, you'll get an audience with Tucker Carlson for that. So suddenly she was on Tucker's show, she was a regular on Steve Bannon's show, and lesser figures of their ilk. And it started to get more and more bizarre and uncanny for me. Here's what I mean. I distinctly remember a moment in the spring of 2021 when she was making the rounds on Fox, and she was saying something that sounded a little like the argument I made in my 2007 book, The Shock Doctrine, about abuses of power under cover of various kinds of emergencies, except with the facts and evidence carefully removed and coming to panic-inducing conclusions that I would never support. For one example, a couple of months after Donald Trump was finally scraped out of the White House, she told Tucker Carlson that the Biden administration was, under the, quote, guise of a medical emergency, using, quote, emergency orders to strip us of our rights to privacy, rights to assembly, rights to worship, all the rights the Constitution guarantees, and it was all a plot, it seemed, by the Chinese. Now, it's hard to describe how I felt watching the clip. A little like she had taken my ideas, fed them into one of those powerful Vitamix blenders, added some tropical fruit, and then shared the thought puree with Tucker Carlson, who nodded vehemently. He then served it to his viewers as a kind of palate cleanser between the usual red meat servings of Great Replacement Theory and Schools Are Turning Your Kids Trans. Meanwhile, Wolf's new followers started to hound me online about why I had sold out to the globalists and was duping the public into believing that masks, vaccines, and restrictions on indoor gathering were legitimate public health measures amidst mass death, as opposed to the pretext for a worldwide shock doctrine. I think she's been got at, someone whose handle is RickyBaby321 concluded, telling Wolf, I have relegated Naomi Klein to the position of being the other Naomi. Now, this continues to happen daily, and I have to tell you, it's a slightly out-of-body experience to be harangued about your alleged misunderstanding of your own ideas while being told that another Naomi is a better version of you than you are. The situation was so weird that I just could not help but get interested in it. Interested in what it means to have a doppelganger. Because in mythology and literature, from Dostoevsky to Ursula Le Guin, doubles and doppelgangers are often seen as warnings or omens. And I got interested in all of these scrambled political signals that she seemed to be a part of, these kind of crossover stars, liberal stars, suddenly showing up on Fox. And I thought maybe by studying her and her new pals, I could understand this world we were in through COVID's portal. I started to watch my doppelganger and her new, the movements that she was a part of, with a kind of anthropological curiosity. I thought that maybe it would help me understand the derangements of our moment. I see her kind of like the white rabbit in Alice in Wonderland, leading down the rabbit hole, or what I call the mirror world, where she now hangs out with Steve Bannon, and who Bannon refers to as the War Room posse on his podcast, The War Room. Now, what I noticed through that looking glass is that the shock doctrine is far from the only left-wing idea for which the right is creating a kind of twisted doppelganger. There are all kinds of strange appropriations and mimicries that go on in there. I'm sure some of you remember the white parents shouting, I can't breathe, about mask mandates, just months after demonstrators in the racial justice uprisings shouted, I can't breathe, in rage and protest about the murder of George Floyd. And they appropriated that Black liberation slogan even as these same people voted for candidates promising to balloon police budgets so that there would be more people for whom these three words might well be their last. And those were some of the same people who we saw holding up placards that said, my body, my choice, about refusing to get vaccinated, but said nothing at all or cheered when the right to safe abortion was stripped in state after state. In Canada, one of the symbols of the movement calling for justice for Indigenous survivors of the residential school system is the orange T-shirt with a slogan that says, every child matters. And wouldn't you know it, a group of anti-vax moms, white moms, decided it would be a good idea to sell orange workout tank tops that declared that the vaccines were Canada's second genocide. And once again, many who have been part of these same COVID denial movements are now turning their energies towards denying the reality of Indigenous genocide, the truths of unmarked graves. And I want to recognize that this is very likely triggering for survivors. But some of these denialists not long ago actually showed up at the site of a former residential school where the unmarked graves were identified with shovels, saying they were there to do their own research. Now, this pattern is rampant. On the one hand, appropriation and trivialization of precious language and symbols used to fight brutal state violence and cover-ups. And on the other hand, aggressive attacks on those very movements, including the pro-cop renaissance, the abortion bans, the wave of book banning, and other attempts to make knowing true history an illegal act. To gain a better understanding of where this is all going, I started to listen to Bannon rather religiously. It started off just when my doppelganger was on, but then it was like, it went beyond that. At a certain point, I couldn't get his theme song out of my head. So yeah, I did the work. I listened to Steve Bannon, so you didn't have to. And I was struck over and over again by the way he took issues that had previously been the political territory of the right, appropriated them, and then mixed them up with all kinds of very dangerous ideas. To put it bluntly, what he seemed to be doing was creating a kind of twisted doppelganger of the left. For instance, he loved to have my doppelganger on to talk about why vaccine apps would bring in tyranny by tech. And he folded this into a basket of issues called Big Tech Warfare, which, let's be honest, could well be a title of a session at Socialism 2023 about drone warfare and border violence and worker surveillance and online censorship of dissident voices from Palestine to Turkey. But in Bannon's world, it's not about any of that. It's about vaccines and social media companies suspending the accounts of high-profile conservatives. And it's also about transhumanism. In fact, he has a dedicated, quote-unquote, transhumanism correspondent whose sole role appears to be to scare listeners with accounts of the many ways that technology companies dream of an upgraded humanity with implants and robotics and gene splicing. Now, I think this deserves our attention because this is Bannon's skill as a strategist. He looks at the issues that are being abandoned by the center left, by the Democrats, and he looks at the people that have been abandoned by the Democrats, and he said, "Hey, come over here. I'm going to solve your problems for you." And then he does a kind of a mix and match, and he did it with a lot of workers in 2016 who had voted for the Democrats again and again, promising that they were going to do something about the free trade deals that had gutted their communities, and they didn't. And then when Trump started talking about it, he got an ear. So this is Bannon's skill. It's how he helped Trump get elected in 2016, and it is how he is trying to get him reelected in 2024. So I realize this may be my weirdest book, but we are in weird times, and we have to pay attention to the weirdness. He has, with this transhumanism and all of this tech anxiety, he has identified a neglected issue with cross-partisan appeal again.
You're listening to Naomi Klein on Conspiracy Culture. This is independent alternative radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Many of us are concerned about the dehumanizing impacts of tech on workers, treated as extensions of machines, not to mention the dystopian possibilities of a future in which the rich can buy genetic upgrades for themselves and their kids. Now, this is a crossover issue because many conservatives oppose this because they believe that it interferes with God's plan, right? So you've got both sides. And most importantly, just as he knew about free trade, Bannon knows that the Democrats aren't doing much of anything about anybody's tech concerns, from data thievery to surveillance, because the revolving door with Silicon Valley is spinning too fast. So a lot of people are going to be attracted to anyone who seems to be doing something, even if it's counterfeit, even if it is a charade. Bannon has recognized similar, and here I'm using Bannon as a stand-in for a whole constellation of lesser-known figures, okay, for whom he is very much an intellectual leader, like it or not. He recognized something similar that was happening with Big Pharma. Drug companies, price gouging and profiteering is a classic left issue. It was an animating part of Bernie's platform, and many here continue to fight for universal public health care and freedom from medical debt. But I think if we're honest, There was not a robust left response to the many ways that the healthcare industry profiteered off the pandemic's back, including the outrageous patents that should never have been allowed to be placed on vaccines that were developed and bulk purchased exclusively with public money.